we've been together for 5 years, and we're actually in the middle of sending out invitations when the marriage ban got passed in Australia. And so we decided to get the working holiday program. We've come here for 12 months.
And they came to my house and said, hey, we have a script. Do you want to play Truman Capote? And I was like, I thought, first of all, that's absurd, because of my image of Truman Capote in my head didn't really fit me.
Yeah, I've decided on a title for my book. I think you'll like it. Very masculine. It's In Cold Blood.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. African Anglican angst advances unabated. A young Aussie couple fights to import their Canadian marriage, and the star of Capote rings true as the infamous author. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 15th, 2005. How much more can tensions over lesbi, gay, and trans inclusion in the Anglican Church continue to rise before the schism pot boils over? The ordination of a British trans woman in late September certainly did nothing to cool the situation. Bishop of Hereford Anthony Pritis called Sarah Jones a person made by God, loved by God, and given gifts by God, who feels that she's called to be a priest. And that's a call that's been checked out by the church rigorously. The Evangelical Alliance, a conservative organization within the Church of England, called Pritis' position blasphemy. Just prior to the announcement of Jones' ordination, the Church of England's role as the mother church of the worldwide Anglican Communion had already been challenged. The Church of Nigeria, the second largest Anglican community, changed its constitution's references to communion with the See of Canterbury to instead affirm its ties with other churches based on the traditional faith, doctrine, sacrament, and discipline of the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. Nigerian Archbishop Peter Akinola, de facto leader of the conservative Global South contingent of African, Asian, and Latin American churches, insists that no actual split is in the offing, but describes their relationship with the Episcopal Church in the United States, the Church of Canada, and the Church of England as broken. Akinola says that a formal separation is not on the agenda when the Global South churches meet in Cairo later this month. The Church of Nigeria's idea of creating some distance from the Church of England may be catching on, however, as a proposal to similarly amend the Australian Church's constitution is being proposed at the upcoming annual Synod of the Sydney Diocese. Sydney Anglicans will also discuss protocols for taking in like-minded Bible-based churches, including uniting church congregations alienated by that denomination's tensions over LGBT issues.
Akinola's unwanted colleague, the once unfailingly optimistic New Hampshire Bishop Gene Robinson, has his doubts about the future of the Anglican Communion. It was Robinson's consecration as the first openly gay Episcopal bishop, as well as the Church of Canada's acceptance of the blessings of same-gender couples, that prompted the revolt of Anglican conservatives. In a recent Associated Press interview, Robinson said the uproar is as much about power and control as it is about theology and scripture. It's about who's going to be calling the shots and who's going to be in and who's going to be out. For signs of the deepening divide, Robinson only has to look to his neighboring state of Connecticut, where six parishes have filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Bishop Andrew Smith. The six plaintiff priests had sought to be supervised by another bishop because of Smith's support for Robinson, and now allege that Smith wrongfully disciplined them without due process. Meanwhile, a newly published book promises to add more fuel to the fire. Gays and the Future of Anglicanism features the arguments of 22 leading theologians opposing the moratorium on gay consecrations and same-gender blessings recommended by the Church's Windsor Report last year. According to Archbishop of Wales Dr. Barry Morgan, who himself participated in writing the Windsor Report, the book shows up the superficiality of previous Anglican discussions of the subject. Morgan says the views expressed should give the Anglican Church in many places cause for penitence for the way it has treated and thought about gay people.
In heavily Catholic Spain, a judge in the capital city of Madrid has ruled that people in same-gender marriages, which were legalized in that country in July, are entitled to the same survivor's pensions as those in traditional heterosexual marriages. The case involved a gay man who married shortly after Spain legalized same-gender unions, but whose male spouse died a month later. The court instructed the government to provide the pension in accordance with the new law. But the conservative opposition party has denounced the law and asked the Constitutional Court to declare it void under Spain's constitution. The party has been split by the controversy, however, especially now that some 60% of the electorate, according to a recent poll, have voiced opposition to conservative efforts to strip gays and lesbians of their equal rights to marriage.
Neither gay and lesbian nor conservative activists really know what to make of Harriet Myers, U.S. President George W. Bush's second nominee for a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, but religious right leader James Dobson thinks he might. Dobson's comment about White House assurances as to her anti-abortion position, broadcast on his Focus on the Family program, have prompted Republican Senate Judiciary Chair Arlen Specter to publicly consider calling the anti-gay minister to testify before the committee during Myers' confirmation hearings. Meanwhile, queer advocacy groups are reflecting on Myers' responses to a 1989 candidate survey by the Lesbian Gay Coalition of Dallas when she ran for city council there. At the time, Myers told the group she supported civil rights for lesbians and gay men, but that she would not support an effort to repeal the Texas sodomy law, which was ultimately struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2003. Myers did not seek and did not receive the Dallas Coalition's endorsement, but members were still somewhat encouraged by her willingness to engage them at all and her subsequent appointment of a gay attorney to a city post.
The recent presidential election in Poland produced no clear-cut winner, so a runoff will be held on October 23rd. The contest will pit the homophobic conservative mayor of Warsaw, Lech Kaczynski, who fought against Poland's first-ever gay and lesbian pride march, against moderate Donald Tusk, who unexpectedly outpolled Kaczynski in the earlier round. Kaczynski's party, Law and Justice, recently won control of parliament, and his party's new prime minister, Kazimierz Marcinkiewicz, has advocated rolling back recent legal protections for gays and lesbians, putting the country on a likely collision course with the European Union, which Poland joined only last year.
A Turkish judge has rebuffed a government official's attempt to shut down that country's only LGBT civil rights organization, a decision hailed as the first legal victory for gays and lesbians since Turkey applied for entry into the European Union. CAOS, the Gay and Lesbian Cultural Research and Solidarity Organization, was being threatened with closure by the deputy governor of the capital city of Ankara on grounds that CAOS is breaking the nation's immorality laws. Although the group has been around since 1994, it only recently sought official registration as a non-governmental agency, normally a mere formality. In denying the deputy governor's request for a ban on the group, Judge Kursat Kairal noted that the American Psychiatric Association does not consider homosexuality a disorder, and that the words gay and lesbian are widely used in daily life and scientific research. While homosexuality is not illegal in Turkey, the government has steadfastly refused to grant specific rights to gays and lesbians. The country has been under increasing pressure to offer protections for LGBT citizens as it pursues full membership in the European Union.
Hong Kong's government has appealed an August 24th ruling striking down a law that punishes gay male sex with life in prison when one or both partners are under 21 years old. Heterosexual sex has no such penalty. Judge Michael Hartman called the statute a grave and arbitrary interference with the right of gay men to self-autonomy in the most intimate aspects of their private lives. The government claims its appeal is based on significant public concern.
Meanwhile, thousands participated in Taiwan's third annual Pride Parade early this month in the capital city of Taipei. Pride spokesperson Ashley Wu said that, although Taiwan's society has become more liberal in recent years, there are still some politicians that make comments discriminating against homosexuals. He also asserted that gays and lesbians face bias in the country's legal system. Said another Pride participant, "We want society to treat us like normal human beings and not see us like aliens or sick people."
More than 1,000 Croatian gay and lesbian civil rights supporters signed their first names to a newspaper ad calling for tolerance and understanding in recent editions of the heavily Catholic country's two largest circulation dailies and in several magazines. Headlined, "We Don't Want to Hide Anymore," the ad also included the ages and sexual orientations of the signatories. In it, they assert, "Little divides us, and a lot unites us. Reconsider your prejudice." Dorino Manzin, head of the LGBT group Iskorak, told the BBC, "Even though it's just a symbolic coming out, without full names, this is a good reflection that gays in Croatia are gathering courage to fully expose themselves and that society is growing more tolerant."
And finally, despite severe legal and societal pressures against them, gay and lesbian Arabs in the Middle East are also organizing. In Beirut, Lebanon, in May, the International Day Against Homophobia was observed by the rights group Helem, which marked the occasion with a gathering of about 200 people, both lesbi, gay, and heterosexual supporters, at a local hotel. The group screened the film I Exist, a documentary on homosexuals in the Middle East, and distributed buttons and pamphlets with the slogan, "You drink coffee, I prefer tea, does that mean one of us is abnormal?" Helem also recently launched what is believed to be the first magazine for gays and lesbians in the region, Barra, which in Arabic means out.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 15, 2005. Written this week by Rick Watts and Lucia Chappelle and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Sherry Lunn.
A new film about queer writer Truman Capote is revealed in Cold Interview and clips later in the program. When Canada became the fourth country in the world to legalize same-gender marriage, it also became the first to allow queer couples from other countries to legally marry there. That opened the door to couples from around the world traveling to Canada to get married and then returning home to fight for legal recognition of their relationships. One of the couples taking up that challenge is trying a different tactic and also staking their claim as the youngest Australian gay couple ever to be legally married. 24-year-old Australian marriage equality leader Luke Gunn tied the knot on September 2nd in Vancouver, British Columbia, with his partner of 5 years, 27-year-old Matthew Culleton, and with family and friends happily celebrating the occasion with them. This Way Out correspondent Heather Kitching spoke with Gunn about fighting for marriage equality in Australia from their current Canadian outpost.
We've been together for 5 years, and we'd joked about marriage, but it was never really a reality. So we never saw it, we sort of just put it back our minds. And
Luke Gunn is the founder of Australian Marriage Equality.
The whole marriage issue had sort of not really entered anyone's consciousness. And Matt and I were traveling about 12 months ago, and we came over to both Canada and the US and met people that had been married. And suddenly it hit us that this is such a fantastic opportunity. So we went home and began planning straight away to come back to get married. We were actually in the middle of sending out invitations when the marriage ban got passed in Australia. And then about less than a month later, the government was re-elected. And when that happened, a lot of our hopes were lost that the marriage ban was going to be annulled. And so we actually we looked into getting working visas in Canada, and so we decided to get the working holiday program. We've come here for 12 months.
Luke and his partner Matthew Culleton have been in Vancouver for 3 months now. They were married on September 2nd. But the government of Australia won't recognize their marriage back at home, and they've been told their options are limited when it comes to trying to fight the government's position.
Unfortunately, we looked at court challenges, and we were all told that unfortunately that there would be no way we could go through the courts because we don't have a Bill of Rights or Charter of Freedoms to actually fall back on. And we started then looking at the possibility of having same-sex marriage at a state level. We never have had marriages since probably about the early 1950s. It all became federal, so we haven't had state-based marriages, and it looks like due to a constitutional glitch, we might be able to get same-sex marriage at a state level. So there are bills before the Tasmanian Parliament, but it's unlikely that those will get passed anytime soon.
So Luke and Matthew have chosen to live in Canada for a year and fight their battle from a distance. Already, their story and the stories of dozens of other same-sex couples who have come here from Australia to marry has created a media profile for the issue back at home. Luke says that when the Australian government passed its same-sex marriage ban, there was little press coverage, and few Australians even knew what had happened. But when Luke and Matthew left the country, a large article in one of the main newspapers in Sydney alerted people to the ban and provided a human face to the issue of same-sex marriage. Still, it will likely be a long time before they change enough people's minds for same-sex marriage to become a reality in Australia.
Yeah, Australia is a very strange place, to say the least. We've had the same government now for 10 years, coming up to 10 years, and it's a conservative federal government. But every single state and territory now has, for the first time, a Labor government, which is our left-wing government. So it's a bit topsy-turvy. But the situation is that both the two major parties have not committed to same-sex marriage or any federal same-sex relationship recognition. It's a bit of a strange situation. We've never had a religious right like in the US. However, in the last 12 months, a new Christian lobby has been formed, and a Christian political party which managed to get one senator elected in Australia, who's already started campaigning to change abortion laws and calls same-sex marriage ban his number one success.
The campaign for same-sex marriage in Australia continues, however. Luke says their current strategy is to lobby state governments, who he feels are more sympathetic to the issue than the federal government. Many state governments already recognize same-sex couples as de facto spouses, with some, if not all, of the same rights that come with marriage. Luke also says that Canadians can play a role in helping end Australia's marriage ban.
I think it'd be a brilliant message that Canadians should actually get active and start contacting, you know, even the Australian High Commission or the Australian Tourist Bureau here in Canada and say, look, we're not coming to Australia now for a holiday, or, you know, we're not going to watch the Commonwealth Games next year in Melbourne because you're outlawing our marriages, and tell them how you feel about that. And even get your heterosexual married friends to write and say, look, it's not fair that you're recognising some of us in Canada as married and others that aren't, even as tourists in the country.
For This Way Out, I'm Heather Kitching in Vancouver.
In my book, Virtually Normal, An Argument About Homosexuality, I explore some strongly held positions about homosexuality in Western society, something that this program has been doing for years. Hi, I'm Andrew Sullivan. From Auckland, New Zealand, to Malmo, Sweden, from Chicago to Costa Rica, listeners all over the world tune in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine, for information, entertainment, and up-to-the-minute news from lesbian and gay communities around the world.
Are you signed up for our monthly emailed This Way Out updates? They briefly preview upcoming programming and give you other behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio program. We also send out weekly email messages about the specific content of each upcoming show. To receive one or both of these messages, all you need to do is email tworadio@aol.com. And be assured that we don't share, sell, or otherwise provide your email address or anything else about you to anyone, and we never will. Again, to receive the monthly This Way Out update and or our weekly program promo message, ask for them by name when you email tworadio@aol.com. It's not your typical biopic. Capote covers just one 5.5-year slice of Truman Capote's life, that pivotal period during which he researched and wrote his groundbreaking 1966 classic, In Cold Blood, a book that changed journalism forever. Oscar buzz is already growing for Philip Seymour Hoffman's haunting performance in the title role. In fact, says This Way Out media mogul Steve Pride, Hoffman does such an astounding job, it almost overshadows the other joys of the film. Catherine Keener's nuanced performance as Capote's friend and To Kill a Mockingbird author Harper Lee, TV actor turned writer Dan Futterman's intelligent script, and Bennett Miller's lyrical direction. Pride talks with star Hoffman about making Capote and shares some clips from what he calls an extraordinary film about an extraordinary but troubled gay man.
On the night of November 14th, two men broke into a quiet farmhouse in Kansas and murdered an entire family. And why did they do that? two worlds exist in this country, the quiet conservative life and the life of those two men with the underbelly, the criminally violent. And those worlds converged that bloody night.
In this dazzling film, Philip Seymour Hoffman is amazing in the title role. But the prolific character actor does not immediately spring to mind when you think of Truman Capote, and he agrees.
They came to my house with the script, Danny and Bennett, who I've known since I was in high school. I didn't go to high school with them, but I met them in the summer program then. And before that time, I'd never thought about it at all. I mean, literally, I probably was thinking about napping or something. And they came to my house and said, hey, we have the script. Do you want to play Truman Capote? And I was like, I thought, first of all, that's absurd. And it really was. It was kind of like, well, that doesn't really. I mean, that was my reaction. It wasn't like, oh, yay, I get to, you know. It was like, what do you mean? You know, because of my image of Truman Capote in my head didn't really fit me.
Like many of us, Hoffman's image of Truman Capote was based on his latter years, long after the writing stopped and he slid into self-parody on the talk show circuit.
Dick Cavett, Johnny Carson. I watched these when I was a child. I'm sure everyone else did. I didn't immediately jump to that image of Truman and me going together. It just didn't. It wasn't the first thing that made me go like, oh, yeah, we're like brothers.
Yeah, I've decided on a title for my book. I think you like it. It's very masculine. It's In Cold Blood. Isn't that good?
I was aware of what he had written, what he was famous for, but this is the journey, right? So that's what I'm aware of at first, is that whole character, that whole personality, that raconteur that entertained us and, you know, made us unnerved and you know, the self-destructive side, the part of his life. And so when I read the screenplay, that was when I was like, oh. And then I read the biography, which if you haven't read it, read it. It's a great read. I mean, it's kind of addictive. And I remember I couldn't put it down. It's very long, and you just can't stop reading it. And then I started to see what they were getting at. You know what I mean? And I started saying, oh, okay, I see maybe why. Maybe they're asking me. But still, I was petrified of having to do all the work that it would take to play him, because it was still such a difference, such a kind of a chasm between us in many ways.
At the heart of this film is the relationship that formed between Truman Capote and one of the killers, Perry Smith.
Thank you. It's as much for me as for anyone. I couldn't bear the thought of losing you so soon.
We're going to be able to use your book for our case. You're right. We never got to raise an insanity plea. You wrote how terrible the lawyers was.
I haven't written a word yet.
What have you been doing?
Research. Talking to you.
Of course, I think he was obsessed. I think he was fascinated. It was the beginning of the end. You know, he saw Perry Smith and he was like, oh my God, who is that? And it's like, for all the reasons, so like, you know, attraction and love are of course going to come out of that. Or part of that, byproduct of that. But like Bennett said, I don't know if you were at the press conference, what Bennett said about the idea of them, you know, that it was some sexual relationship, I think is, to me, my answer to that is kind of like, I don't think it happened. But even if it did, it's not something that I think is really important. I think it would dilute the actual real tragedy that happened here, which happens to do with the end of a writer's life, you know. So yes, but of course, I think he wanted to eat him. I mean, I think it was like, if he could have just digested this guy, he would have.
The film presents Truman Capote, warts and all. He bonded with the killers. He helped them find lawyers for their appeals and visited them in prison. But he needed their execution. He needed an ending for his book. And this conflict is so brilliantly portrayed by Philip Seymour Hoffman that it made my skin crawl.
They only exacerbate problem. They only heighten or intensify it. Maybe we can get them started on the program.
I know what exacerbate means.
Okay, well, I'm just thinking.
There's not a word or a sentence or a concept that you can illuminate for me. There is one singular reason I keep coming here.
Truman.
November 14th, 1959. 3 years ago. 3 years. That's all I want to hear from you.
Truman Capote was a raconteur, He was the life of the party, and as portrayed in the film, this seems almost as important to him as his work, as his writing.
What life was he choosing? I think he was choosing acceptance.
Actor Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And what part of society that, what meaning, like he liked to hang out with a high society, but some of the men he ended up dating were from a whole different class level. You know what I mean? It's like where he wanted acceptance was really anybody's guess. You know what I mean? And I stand by that. I don't think he was just looking for one thing. I think he was looking for something from a lot of different people in a lot of different areas, because I think his need was so great, you know? So I don't, you know, I'm wary of saying that Truman Capote sat there and was like consciously going, I think he wanted to be a part of that world. He became a part of it. I think he wanted also to be a part of this world, and he became a part of it. I think when he chose to be a part of something, he made it happen.
Because since I was a child, folks have thought they had me pegged because of, you know, the way I talk. And they're always wrong.
My job wasn't to do a Saturday Night Live sketch or a caricature. My job was to tell a story. In a very honest human way. My job was first and foremost to tell a story. My job, even the primary aspect, wasn't even to play him correctly, was to tell this story. And one of the aspects in Givens to tell this story was to get a sense of him as honestly and as soulfully as possible, so that you would forget about the image that I had when they offered me the role. Do you see what I'm saying? You would forget the raconteur personality, talk show, Saturday Night Live sketch guy. You would see the prolific, intelligent, witty, sharp, ambitious, duplicitous writer of a generation. I needed to embody that thing, and that's what made me want to do it, because I said, if you're telling that story, I want to be a part of it.
Prior to the release of In Cold Blood, Truman Capote was a prolific writer. His work included the lyrics for the Broadway musical House of Flowers, the screenplay for the Humphrey Bogart film Beat the Devil, the novel Other Voices, Other Rooms, and the novella Breakfast at Tiffany's, which was turned into a classic film with Audrey Hepburn. After the publication of In Cold Blood, perhaps his greatest work, Capote never finished another book or play. This has been a conversation with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Capote was directed by Bennett Miller, based on the book Capote by Gerald Clark, with a screenplay by Judging Amy actor Dan Futterman. It also stars Catherine Kinnear and is a Sony Pictures Classic release. For more information on Capote or other films of gay interest, visit prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Sherry Lund, John Beaupre, Lucia Chappell, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Heather Kitching, and Steve Pride contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Don't forget, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to find out how you can help keep this program on the air. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KPOV Bend, Oregon, WOJX Northampton, Massachusetts, 5RRR Woomera, South Australia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.